Now, where does all that come to?
The conviction, you know, those...
Oh, yes. Yeah, and so you... Oh, I know. There was several things I was going to say about that. It's hard to gauge. Because... And then all the years after that, and I moved to Ananda about a year after that. It took me a year to extricate my karma. You know, I sort of pass over all my own karma when I tell the story in the book. I just say, soon after. But I had a little bit of karma that I had to get through. And then I got there, and almost as soon as I was there, I started working with him. I became his secretary. I saw him every day for a decade, you know, like that. And in all the years since, we've always been in touch, even though for 20 years I haven't even lived on the same community, and sometimes not even the same continent. But the fact of the matter is, he did so many things I didn't understand. He answered my questions, and I asked him, you know, why did you do that? What were you doing? Here's one example that's not in the book. But I was sitting with this woman, and we were together, and Swamiji came, Swamiji is what I call him. He came and sat down, and he spoke to that woman for just a minute. And then he just got up and walked away. I mean, it looked just incredibly rude. But later, he brought it up to me. He must have felt in my mind. It was like, what are you doing? But then he explained to me that this woman was making certain demands upon him that were just inappropriate. And he sat with her essentially to see if she was still in that inappropriate mood. And as soon as he perceived that he had to show her that he was not going to relate to her on the level that she was asking, and so he just got up and walked away. I mean, it was a very appropriate gesture, and this is the way I began to think about it. And this is the way that you can often think about it, so you don't have to make yourself dumb, because it doesn't serve your cause to make yourself dumb. I had a very keen mind, and I could see what I could see. But I didn't realize that sometimes things started way out of my box, and I was just watching them cross my little screen. Crossing my little screen, it looked a certain way, but when he knew where it was starting and he knew where it was going, sometimes what happened in my little screen was quite different. And I have to say, honestly, not once has he ever disappointed me. He's always known what he was doing. There, I know once he publicly scolded this man, which he rarely did, but he publicly scolded this man, and he got this angry letter from someone, how dare you treat so-and-so like this? People don't hesitate to speak their minds in this country. And Swamiji's answer, very, very straight answer. He invited the man over to talk. He said, for me to explain to you why I treated him the way I did, I would have to tell you more about him than you have any right to know. Sometimes he would tell me he felt I had a right to know, but I didn't challenge him in that sort of angry way either. My questions were always, you know, what is this about? Why are you doing this? Because mine was based on the fact that my intuition was that he knew what he was doing. So, but I don't understand what you're doing, so maybe you could explain it to me. And very often the people involved didn't even know what he was doing. It would be years. That's what my book is full of, that. People, they don't know. But afterwards I would know because he would tell me, so I could write a book about it. So the end of all that is you can't always tell what someone more advanced than you is doing, because by the very nature of it, it's beyond your comprehension in certain ways. You can sense it. You can see it much of the time. You can see it in the writings. You can hear it in the speech. You can feel it in the vibration. But one of the very best ways to tell what a teaching is about is to look at those who have practiced it. And I don't mean everyone, because one of the great things about a great teacher is that he can help people on all levels. One of Yogananda's very advanced disciples was a man named Oliver Black. Mr. Black, he was generally called for some reason, or Yogacharya Oliver. And he was a very advanced soul. He lived into his 90s, but he's passed away now. He lived in Detroit. He was a self-made millionaire, maybe in the auto business. I'm not sure what it was. But he ran a ministry there, and he complained to Master. He said, Master, all I seem to get are the halt, the blind, and the lame. And Yogananda said, Oliver, they're your people. Just like that. Sister Durgamata, who was also a very advanced disciple of Yogananda, she wrote a beautiful book called The Trilogy of Divine Love. Her specific ministry, just for some reason, was to people who are mentally unbalanced. So, you know, it wasn't possible to look at her devotees necessarily and see in them shining examples of what you wanted to become. But, you know, often the people who come to a spiritual path are not those whose lives are working beautifully. Because if your life is working beautifully and everything is a success and you're at the top of your game, why would you look for anything else? Very often you come to the spiritual path because on some level, something has happened to you that's cracked this little thing for you. But you have to look for other qualities. But you look at the people who follow the path, and you look at those who seem to be real exemplary examples of the path. And what you see in them is what the path actually is, because they're the fruit of whoever it is you're looking at or whatever it is you're looking at. And then they also will manifest the spirit of it. You know, and so you go to some groups, some ashrams, and what you see around you is the vibration of the teaching brought down to the level that it's going to express through you. And I went to when we were traveling once. I don't ashram hop very much. I rarely go see anyone else. I don't have any need to or inspiration to. But this was 25 years ago. David and I were traveling in Southern California, and a very well-known woman teacher was giving a satsang, so we just went because we were there and we'd heard about her. And it was this huge hall, there were thousands of people there, and they started out by putting the men on one side, the women on the other, in the traditional Indian manner. And then we started chanting. I wasn't able to chant because the stupid harmonium's notes are all buzzy, but most of you have heard Ananda chanting. It's very melodic, it's very up. They started chanting a Shiva chant. This is what it sounded like to me. Om Namo Shivaya. Om Namo Shivaya. And it was, you know, there was power in it. Om Namo Shivaya. But I thought, God, I don't want to have anything to do with this path. It just wasn't me. You know, it just, and the people who were doing it were really into it. I'm exaggerating it, but that really was, there was no melody. And there was no, you know, like this. It was just, let's get down to work and make this happen. And that was really the vibe of the whole place. And I'm happy if it worked for them, but boy, it did not work for me. I just walked out saying, I'm so glad that's not my path. But more, I just knew it wasn't because it didn't resonate, you know? And some people come into Ananda and they just find it unnecessarily frivolous and just too much going on and just way too peppy and just all these different things. But we're a reflection of Yogananda, we're a reflection of Kriyananda. This is what he's taught us to do. You have to, like P.G. Woodhouse, you know, that's part of what we do, is we read funny stories and we put on costumes and we play games. But what you really see is this tremendous, deep, underlying sense of happiness. You know, just a very, and you see an expansive way of thinking, an all-inclusive way of thinking, and not everybody wants that. So the first question when you're asking for a spiritual path is look at those who follow it and see if you want to be one of them. And that doesn't mean you necessarily even like them. There's the oddest thing. Some of my best friends I don't particularly like. I mean, it's not about personality. It's not about whether or not you share interests. It's on a much deeper vibrational level where you have this, I mean, I'm joking when I say some of my best friends I don't like. But I realized once that it wasn't about liking. It was about this other kind of resonance where there's just this sincere energy moving forward and you're on the same wavelength with that. So you can't put aside, and this is again with all due respect, and I'm not picking on you, but you just said what people say. Oh, I'm not into the organization. I'm not into the other people. Well, how are you going to evaluate it if you don't look at the fruit? That's what they asked Jesus. How can you tell a true teaching from a false teaching? How can you tell a true prophet from a false one? It's been the dilemma, it was the dilemma in his time. I mean, partly the question is how can you tell if Jesus was true when all the power structure were saying that he wasn't? You know, John the Baptist said he was, but who was John the Baptist? He was a madman, you know, living on roots and berries and dressed in animal skins and telling them all to repent. I mean, he was like, this is an authority, how do I know? And Jesus said, by the fruits. A good tree gives good fruit. A bad tree cannot give good fruits. Look at the fruits. See what you look at. I mean, you look at all of Ananda when... And then you find that other people will challenge your judgment. If you can go right now, if you want to, on the internet, and you can find really incredibly, appallingly scurrilous charges against Kriyananda, saying, and this was, you know, in the newspapers, it's almost a decade ago, but it still lives on the internet, you know, that he's a sexual predator, that Ananda is just a sham organization, that everything that happens here is really just a pretense and it's all about power and money. And, you know, there was a lawsuit. I mean, there was a huge thing that happened where people said that we were just terrible. And people can, you can find that if you want to. And then what do you think? I mean, when people would come to me with that, I say, well, why don't you hang around for a while and see what you think? You know, do, you know, meet the women and the men here, see what they seem like to you. You know, is that what it feels? And then this great fear comes in. And what happens is that great fear comes in, and the fear of being fooled is greater than the possibility of being true. And then people back out. But on every spiritual path that you will follow, and this is very important, one of the things that will happen is you'll start into it, and then a force of negativity will come to try to persuade you that you shouldn't do it. Maybe it'll be your mother. Maybe it'll be somebody who knows that this is really false. Whatever it might be. And then one has to kind of go through this reality of when we were 10 years ago in the midst of, we had this extremely false lawsuit of sexual misconduct that took place in Redwood City for 3 months. And every day the Palo Alto Daily had some new headline about how awful we were. My favorite was, "The Swami and His Zombie Sex Slaves." I'm not kidding. You know, zombie sex slaves. And I would say, what do you think? You know, it's just like, I mean, it was lunatic, but it terrified people. And people, just last week, two different people asked me about, what about all that stuff that was in the paper like that? And even in the midst of it, I would just say, what do you think? You know, you can't defend yourself against, if people will lie about you, you can't say, they're lying. So I just said, what do you think? It was a great experience because you had to actually ask yourself, what do I think? So the spiritual path is about learning to just get into your own reality sufficiently and to do sufficient spiritual practices. Now here's one more point on this and then I'll give you a chance to speak. When I met Swamiji, I had an absolute conviction about him. I didn't know anything about Yogananda, really. I owned autobiography, but I'd never read it. In fact, I was following the teachings of Ramakrishna, which is a very similar path, and I was attending their temples. I'd never taken initiation or really gone beyond being, you know, a temple goer. But Ramakrishna had been a tremendous blessing in my life. He was a master who lived in the 1800s. And I just sort of didn't know what to do about that because he'd been such a blessing in my life. I felt to go this way, but this was another teaching. But I just decided I would go with what I did know. What I did know was there was a personification in front of me that had what I was seeking. I didn't see it anywhere else. And it just, there was just this arrow-like, I was fortunate, tremendous commitment. And I sort of said to Ramakrishna and to Yogananda, this is your problem, not mine. Because once you're involved in true teachings, there's no competition for disciples. And here was the further thought, and this is the most important point I want to get across. The reason I couldn't perceive, you know, sort of where do I belong, was because I didn't have sufficiently developed intuition to be able to have that certainty. I was certain of Swami Kriyananda. I wasn't certain of the implications of it. I was totally certain of him. But I decided that I was never going to develop the intuition to have greater certainty unless I did some spiritual work. Unless I did serious spiritual practice. If I refused to do spiritual practice because I'm not certain which my path is, I would never develop the intuition to know what my path was. But if I followed wholeheartedly, as if I were certain, a teaching that I knew was true, then the practice of it would develop my consciousness, so then the certainty would come. So I just entered into Ananda and my relationship with Swami, and I really had no doubt whatsoever. I mean, it all felt so at home. There was this little problem of the blessings I'd received from Ramakrishna and how did this all fit in. And I just completely put it on the shelf. And one day, about a year after I was living at Ananda Village, I woke up one morning, I said, of course this is your path. What could you have been thinking? But there was nothing in between. It was just like layers of my consciousness expanded until it was crystal clear to me what to do. But I know if I had stood back for fear of knowing, I'd still be standing there to this very day. So there's always there, that's where the disciple guru has to come. We want it all spelled out for us. We want to be just in our present state of consciousness. We want to put out no work. We want to make no changes. We want to relinquish none of the ego. We want the divine to come down to our level, spell it out for us in written words. But that won't get us anything, because that there's no certainty in that kind of knowledge. You see? You just get it all written out, and then somebody writes out something else. And then you've got two of them, and you don't know what to do. You have to step out of that realm in the spiritual realm. So the masters, they don't sell this cheap. You know, this is just not like going to Best Buy and then to Fry's and see where you get the best deal. This is a question of whether or not one has the courage and the self-understanding and the sensitivity and then the willingness to put out energy after that thought. And then they'll come to us, but not until. And if we demand otherwise, it's just, you know, nobody's going away. But we have to rise to that level. They won't rise to ours. They won't sink to ours. Does that make sense? Questions, comments, thoughts? Yes, John.
Well, I mean, even what you kind of said about needing to do some work first before you can even have maybe enough wisdom or intuition to make the decision about who you're guru is or who your path is, whatever, so forth. So, I mean, in a sense, it almost implies that you need to follow someone's teachings.
Yes.
You get the point. Now, I understand a lot of people sometimes there's all different routes. Some people became very interested in say, New Age kind of teachings or something that maybe led them into something more developed and more serious. Some people may have been devout in one religion, but they had enough of a faith, and they completely changed paths from being a Catholic or something to being, following a yogi guru, but they had some development. Now, I have a question of what kind of sometimes where you start with that intuition, because I can say from my own personal experience, I was really sure maybe a year or two ago that Yogananda was my guru, because I loved his books, his teachings, and so on and so forth. But then, within the last year or so, I completely doubted that that's the case anymore. You know, and not that I still don't love Yogananda's teachings, but I guess something kind of logical kind of entered my mind and saying, well, it seemed really important to me to have a living guru. You know. Someone that I can talk to. You've had the experience of with Swami Kriyananda. You know, he, in all practical sense, he's a physical embodiment of a guru for you. It seems, natural for a student to be able to actually ask a teacher questions. It's a very traditional way of studying with a guru, even in any religion. So it was difficult for me to understand, well, Who do I go to ask these great questions that you're going to come up with? Who do you go to get these profound answers that you're eventually going to run into when you develop to a certain point? So I began searching for different teachers, and all of a sudden something kind of changed with me, you know. But I haven't taken initiation with anybody yet, with Yogananda or with the other teacher who I believe seems likely that he's going to be my guru, my teacher. But I don't know, like, almost the catch-22 is almost like, you can't really feel attuned with somebody until you take an informal initiation and begin to study their things.
I disagree with that.
Yeah.
Let me answer a lot of what you asked, because okay. Those are very, very, very good questions, John. I don't know, I think the microphone picks you up, but the essential question is the question of the need for a living teacher, mm-hmm. having a strong draw to Yogananda, but feeling doubt because of that, because Swami Kriyananda is in a different phase of his life, not having as much access to him as was in the past, so you can't get it through that. I'm going to give it from a lot of different angles. Here's an interesting one, just starting from the quote, the need for a living teacher. There is definitely the need for living contact. The master himself said that. You have to have living contact. But Yogananda, even when he was living, he gave that contact and instruction through his disciples. So the master can speak clearly through those who are devoted to him. And that's number one, that the concept that you need some direct contact is true. But the question is, where does that direct contact come from? And now let me go on from there. If you're dealing with a self-realized master, an avatar, a person of perfect realization who comes only to inspire, has no karma of his own, such souls do not take incarnation that often. Yogananda has had many other incarnations, but he doesn't come back as regularly as we do. So if you're going to demand that your master be embodied, the fact of the matter is you're going to be on this planet a lot more than he is, or she, although it's usually he and when it's a self-realized master. So there's going to be many incarnations in which your relationship is going to have to be through others who are in tune with that teacher. Otherwise, you'll have to change gurus every incarnation. So that's just answering that question on a perfectly logical level. If you want somebody who's there, you have to take who's ever around, but the true power may be coming from somewhere else. I mean, Jesus has continued to be able to turn individuals into self-realized masters because the master can come in vision, but practically speaking, the master comes through his disciples. Does not come through the organization. He does not come through books. He may awaken you through books, but the living presence comes through other living individuals. Now, the other thing about that is there's a law of efficiency in spiritual teaching, which is a fact even when Kriyananda was very accessible, which is if one takes full advantage or makes full use of the spiritual opportunities that are given to you, then God gives you more. If one holds back saying, well, this one isn't exactly what I want, and that isn't exactly what I want, and I'm not into organized groups, and I'm just going to wait till the self-realized master comes, and what does he know anyway, and who is that one? And yet all those spiritual opportunities are given to you, and you don't take them, why would God give you more? And I've watched this. Again, I have 40 years in this. I've watched many people come through, hundreds, probably thousands of people, 20 years here, 16 years at Ananda Village. Before that, 5 years traveling around the country teaching people. And people who just were hungry. You see, if you're really hungry, you don't really care exactly whether the zucchini was braised or steamed. If you're really hungry, you will eat it. If you're really hungry for vegetables, you will eat them as they are given to you, and then you can refine them later. If you're not really hungry, in the sense that one is more interested in one's own reality than other realities, and you don't really take advantage of what comes, then nothing more comes. And I'm not just speaking to you, John, so I don't want you to take this personally, but you open the question. And there's another aspect to it also. If we don't take advantage of it, you don't feel an ongoing inspiration. A friend of mine recently articulated this thought for me. I never exactly put it this way. And I was talking about how eclectic people are and just how they'll do this one for a while, then that one for a while, then they'll go over to here and go over to there. The man answered me perfectly. He said, it's a substitute for spiritual practice. Because in order to have ongoing, ever-deepening inspiration, you have to really work on your own consciousness. You have to, do the methods. And I don't just mean you have to be able to meditate hours a day, because that's not everybody's path. But you have to drink from the fountain, whether it's service or satsang, which is the company of others, or sadhana, which is your own practice. You have to drink from the fountain, and then you develop your capacity to receive, and you receive more. But if you don't drink from the fountain, gradually inspiration dries up. Because it's a closed system. It's come into you and you're not doing anything with it. So gradually it dries up. So you go find somebody else. And then you feel all inspired again. And in this particular area, you can just go from here to here. On Fridays I do this. On Thursdays I do that. I do Tai Chi this night. I go to the Buddhist on that night. I go out to Ananda on this day. I go here. And you can go long, long time that way. But you won't you'll always be energized, conceivably. But you won't necessarily be transformed. Because that kind of shopping, and it's good to shop at the beginning. Not everyone should marry the first person they meet, although sometimes you're lucky like that. But sometimes you have to just get a little experience under your belt. But at a certain point, you have to really drink from the fountain in order to make the flow happen. And if you don't do that, it doesn't necessarily mean that it wasn't your path. It may just mean that you haven't yet really fully understood the disciple side of the disciple-guru relationship. Or it could mean it's not your path. But you have to really, it's a dicey question. So I've often seen people hang out with Master, with Yogananda, with Ananda for a while, and then they just go do something else. And this was behind them. And it wasn't necessarily that it was right for them to leave. It was just that they needed an external change to renew their inspiration. And sometimes it's just the karma of the situation. People don't have the karma to go really deep anywhere. Sometimes it's a question of whether it's the right path or not, and I have to be very honest, most of the time it's not. Most of the time it's not a question of whether this is yours, it's a question of whether or not you've ever really put yourself into it or just drifted off to something else. People have left Ananda after 20 years. Amazing to me. But it's because they never really made the deep connection on a superconscious level, and so something else comes in and it seems exciting, and then they're just off like that. And how do I know that that's a good or a bad thing? By the fruits. And because I'm not dogmatic, and there's lots of true paths, and people do find one for a while and they go on to the other, I was just saying that. But often, it's restless. And this justification, I need a living teacher. Yes, you absolutely need a living teacher, but the question is, have you drawn as much as you can from the living sources that are around you, or are we falling for somebody's taking a position of, I'm the guru, I'm the teacher? And, you know, Kriyananda himself, he won't take the position of guru. His picture is behind the wall there, I have to flip these two. He won't take the position of guru. He's now, I mean, for most of the years I've known him, he would hardly take the position of teacher. Everything was about Yogananda. More recently, he's admitted what we've all known, which is that he's the doorway for many of us to Yogananda through him, because he is present. He manifests it. But let me try to. But he's never taken the role of guru. I jokingly, I have this in my book. I said to him once, sir, if you would just, the way I put it was, let us follow you around with a white umbrella, which is in the tradition in India, is that, you know, you don't even, the disciple has the role and they keep the guru's head covered from the sun with this white umbrella, and, you know, everything that happens. We were in this little ashram in India and they were rolling out these sheets so that the guru didn't have to step on the ground, and anybody who accidentally stepped on the sheet was reprimanded. I mean, it just went on and on. It was absurd. Swami Kriyananda has never allowed any of that to happen, because so much of that then takes away from the individual the freedom to decide for yourself what the consciousness of this person is. It's all predetermined. And it's been actually a great grief to me that Swami Kriyananda's reputation has expanded to the point that it has. And I'm kind of glad, and I don't really mean this, but you know, the fact that some people don't like him is helpful. Because if everybody liked him, then no one would have to think. And if he played more of the guru game, then you wouldn't have to think at all. There's a great deal of difference between claiming a reality and having it. Now, does that answer your question?
Yeah. It doesn't matter. Of course, I still have some, it's not even a confusion. I mean, you know, the idea of, say, you on a personal level, you had 40 years to relate to someone.
Right.
You know, and it's almost, in a sense, well, we have these great masters, and then we have their disciples who, in their own way, are great, but it almost seems like every generation removed from the master, the teachings get a little bit more...
No, John, that's not true. Because any disciple who's... You have Padre Pio in the last...
Yeah,
you know,
I understand. That's true.
It can be true, but it's not always
right,
true.
It can be true. I shouldn't say it.
Yeah.
Always,
and because that, it just, that just leaves you in an impossible... That means that you can never be a disciple of a self-realized master unless you're contemporary with him.
Right. No. Yeah, and I understand that's not a fact.
Yeah.
No, but I guess I'd say that it's, well...
Let me add a thought, and then I'll let you finish yours. What you have to understand is, and it's even true with Kriyananda, he will not take the role of guru.
Right.
But he will help us understand what it is to be a disciple.
Right.
See, that's the key. And so the power is the unlimited power of the avatar. But what Kriyananda has manifested in his life, and this is what he manifests, how to be a disciple. Because unless you understand how to be a disciple, it doesn't make any difference who the guru is.
Right, and that I do understand.
Yeah.
Of course, but there is, we'll say that Well, then there's two ways to go. You could either say, well, it doesn't matter at all then who your guru is, if you choose to tune in with him. Then another side of thinking will say, well, there's different gurus for different personalities.
Absolutely. And right, so, right. That's exactly
so
right.
So the Catholic Church would have you say, or whatever, that it doesn't matter where you came from or what background you grew up in or
right.
what part of the world you grew up in, that Jesus is you relate to. We see, even interestingly, when you travel around the world, they make pictures and portraits of Jesus in churches look like the local people.
Exactly.
But
and Mother Mary has appeared looking like,
right.
you know, with dark skin to dark skinned people. Yeah.
But it's, but you know, so that's one extreme. And then the other extreme would be, well, you could have the guru of the week, you know, and you could go.
Exactly.
And but many people go that path too,
yeah.
you know. I know a girl, every week she goes to a different
right,
seminar.
Exactly.
He's the greatest. And then it's another
exactly.
week later, oh, no, I'm not interested in him anymore. And,
no.
You know, you can endlessly do that too, and that's not interesting either. But I guess it's a question of
It's a question of your own intuition, John.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I don't know where the intuition exactly comes from.
And I mean, that would be if you spoke of the fact, that would be something you and I should talk about if you want me to. I mean, you had mentioned that you'd wanted to,
okay.
otherwise I wouldn't suggest it, because it would have to be. Just about you.
Right.
I took your question and I answered it in principle.
Right.
Then the question is you.
Right.
You know, what are you? What do you really resonate with?
Right.
And who really does belong to you? And that's a completely different discussion. Because by no means is this the only valid path in the world, and by no means is this the only valid teacher or teaching. The need for personal guidance is valid. To make the first criteria of your spiritual path that reality, that the individual who's the apex of the tradition be accessible to you in a certain way, may be the deciding factor. It may not be.
Right. Okay. And that's my question.
Yeah.
Maybe, and maybe not. It's a logical thing. You know, it is a logical thing for me. As I said, logic more than intuition, more than heart. My brain says, well. Asha had the pleasure of
right.
being able to speak with Swami Kriyananda for 40 years, to work with him, when Swami Kriyananda is no longer here,
what will happen then?
Right, you know, and everyone's getting older.
And all these are very real questions, but here's the answer to that as I see it. Yogananda passed away and we never met him, and yet many people have a relationship with him. It was never based on any physical contact.
And I know plenty of people met him and got nothing out of it.
And many people met him and got nothing out of it.
I remember read a great book about Swami Sivananda, this great book uh-huh. by one of his female disciples at the ashram in the 1950s. And she said she was amazed as she talked to one woman there who seemed he had disdain for Swami Sivananda, a great saint. And she said, well, why are you here? And she said, because it's free and the food is good.
Mm-hmm.
And she lived there for years, and she didn't even pretend to like him.
Strange world, isn't it? Yogananda put it in terms of, he said, there's a lot of rats and mice living in the canyon where this ashram is, and they're not really getting anything.
Said the same thing, yeah. He said most of the people here are here for because it's free.
And the glamour, and it's, so those are all extremely valid questions that have to be worked out within ourselves.
So can I follow that up with just another more
sure.
broad question then? If we kind of understand the teachings or are in tune with the teachings of a great master like Yogananda or someone on his level, is there any validity in reading or studying books of other, we'll say, lesser teachers?
It depends. Okay. Can we go another half hour without a break, or do you all need a break?
No, we can go on.
Is that all right? Okay, because we only have a half hour left. There's an element of transference of vibration, and it's not just, since we're talking, it's not just the physical, it's not through the physical body. It's, you know, Yogananda demonstrated to Kriyananda in certain circumstances that he was conscious of what Kriyananda was doing and thinking, even when Yogananda had been hundreds of miles away. Swamiji's response to Master, as he called him, was, "You know?" And Master said to Kriyananda, he said, "I know every single thought that you're thinking." And I asked Swamiji, I said, "Is that still true?" And Swami just looked at me and he said, "Of course." That was his response. "Of course it's still true." that that when you invite the guru into your life, then his vibration is always with you. And it's very much, I use the example of, I sometimes sing in the choir. I'm an adequate singer, I'm not a great singer. I sing much better when other people are singing the melody around, the parts around me, because I can just hear them more clearly. Well, spiritual path is my own responsibility, but when I can inwardly feel the vibration of Master with me, or Swamiji with me, then I can tell more easily when I'm going off the melody. You know, whether it's an unkind thought, a wrong decision, a certain inability to discipline myself, because the note is humming, then I sense myself that I'm moving out of attunement with that. That's the receiving him. Now, the capacity to receive is not just a question of, oh, I think I'll be a disciple. The capacity to receive is the moment-by-moment effort on the part of the disciple. The way Yogananda put it is this way. He said, spiritual progress is 25% the disciple's effort, 25% the effort of the guru on behalf of the disciple, and 50% the grace of God, which means the disciple's part is only a quarter of the equation. But if the disciple fails to do that quarter, the other 75% never gets to you. Because if I'm standing in that choir just singing my own song and not listening to the other people sing, it doesn't matter how perfectly they're singing it. If I'm not making an effort to attune myself, I won't hear it. I won't even know that I'm out of tune. So that's the very subtle art of the spiritual path. That's the disciple part of it. You can be a very good disciple before you have a guru. And in fact, you really have to become a disciple before you have a guru, because you have to have this willingness. See, oftentimes people misunderstand the concept of inner guidance, because we have many levels within us. And so we can have very strong, compelling feelings about things, but they're not necessarily upward moving. They're just habitual or self-enclosed. So it's a little bit subtle. That's why coming to places where the vibrations are there and you begin to know what it feels like to be in tune with that vibration gives you a point of reference. And you can say, oh, I have a strong feeling about this, but it doesn't have that quality that I've grown accustomed to associating with higher guidance. I mean, this is something that we all just slowly learn, and you usually learn it by making horrendous mistakes. And you have to have the courage to make horrendous mistakes. But the ability of that subtle vibration to get into has nothing to do with sitting in front of a person who talks to you. A person can sit in front of you and talk to you and be very explicit with you and give you exact directions, but if you haven't received the vibration, it's the vibration that changes you, because that's what actually rearranges your chakras. Otherwise, it's just a mind game. So one, the teacher has to have the power to do that, which is why these masters can reach everyone, because they're omniscient. They have literally, an avatar has unlimited power to uplift as many people as will receive him. So how do you stay in that attunement? Well, it seems to begin with, you have to focus on it. If you're moving around, this was the specific question, reading a little of this, reading a little of that, picking up a little information here, getting an inspiration there, obviously you're singing a lot of different songs. And each one of those teachers can be valid in himself or herself, but if their vibration is not the same, then you vibrate for a little while in tune with this one, then you vibrate in tune with this one, and then you vibrate in tune with this one, and several things happen. One is, you're never quite entirely clear what you're trying to hear. The second thing is, the masters themselves can't take responsibility for you because you yourself have made no commitment. And they don't interfere. You know, there's this fear people have that somehow the guru or the teacher is going to, you know, take over your life or interfere. My answer is, no such luck. You know, they will only, but Master said that to Swami in that same conversation, but I only go where I'm invited. And if he's not invited, the sanctity of your own privacy is completely respected. So if you don't, I mean, just in a human relationship, a human relationship is a perfect example. If you like someone, but sometimes you're with that woman, and sometimes you're with that woman, and sometimes you're over here, and you're kind of available, but not really, and like this, then how much is that person going to give you? How much are they going to come into you? They, you're not serious. They're not going to commit their life to you. They're going to say, when you grow up and are ready to commit, then I'll be with you. It's a love relationship. So the masters also want to know if we're really committed. Because if we're not committed, it's not a question of, you know, it's not like a human relationship where they're afraid of getting hurt. It's that they can't work with us. And they're not going to squander. This is not something that is just, it's not pearls before swine. It's not just cast out there and if you want it, you can have it. No, no. It's something you have to really earn. Because if you're not willing to discipline yourself, nothing's going to happen anyway. So the reason why the teachers often say, only read from this path, only read these teachings, or these that are close, so closely associated with that the vibration is the same, is so that you will develop a vibration and there can be a meshing of that energy. So I know people often come to me, oh, this is such a great book. It's almost like Master's teachings. It's so compatible with Master's teachings. And if I'm talking to someone who's on this path, I rarely articulate it, but the thought crosses my mind. Well, why don't you just read Master's teachings? Why are you reading something that's almost like it? And the reason people are often doing it is because we get restless.
Yeah, but there's also, I mean, for me, sometimes there's a degree of information that I'm interested in, and that's maybe Yogananda himself hasn't explained very much about. And sometimes I say if I'm reading a book about mantra chanting, for example, something Yogananda never really talked much about, and you know, it's sometimes just, you know, I wonder how far. You know, the validity of the teacher sounds perfectly reasonable when he writes this book about it. And then I wonder, well, you know, how far can you expand the circle, you know, and still be within the...
Well, see, it's a question of, you know, when you really have a guru-disciple relationship, you believe that this guru is all-encompassing and can take you as far as you need to go. So you no longer think, oh, but he doesn't include this. I better go get this.
Right.
No, it would be just like a human relationship. Right. Oh, this woman is wonderful, but I like this one too. You know, so...
I feel that way a lot of times.
Okay.
Know? And also, it's...
Yeah.
Let me say further, just on... Again, this is a logical thing. It's not a challenge. Sometimes I wonder how many people are really, I don't know, like not within Ananda or anything. There's so many different teachers I see. I wonder how many students are really advancing on this path. If you were even like selling people anything you're going to sell someone, a health product, for example, and you said only 1 in 10,000 people who take this thing, they're going to cure themselves of cancer. But 1 in 10,000 are going to reach there, and the rest of you may stay alive for a little bit longer or whatever, but this special treatment you can get at Stanford or whatever, 1 in 10,000 of you are going to completely cure yourself of cancer. Not many people would figure that would be...
Well, see, the answer... No, actually, John, that statistic is exactly that. Krishna says, out of 1,000, one seeks God. Out of 1,000 who seeks, one realizes God. Now, two things to that. Yogananda said, quote, our percentage is higher.
Right.
And the second thing that happens is that Arjuna, in the Bhagavad Gita, in response to that, basically says, essentially, well, the odds seem pretty poor. So what if I devote myself to this and I don't realize God, and I've turned my back on the world and I haven't achieved this goal? I mean, it just pretty seems like a bad deal to me. I mean, it's all poetically written, but that's just exactly that question. And Krishna answers that in the phrase... The famous phrase in answer to that question is, my devotee is never lost, meaning it isn't an all or nothing. And then he goes on to explain, and this Kriyananda is explained in many places. You see, this is Krishna's line in the Gita. Even a little practice of this inward religion will free you from dire fears and colossal sufferings. It's not an all or nothing. It's even a little bit of practice begins to expand your awareness and give you a little taste of Satchitanandam. So even if you don't become entirely free, the way Swami puts it, every step you take on the path moves you into a greater realm, increases your capacity for bliss and your experience of it. So even if you don't make it all the way to the end of the journey, you progress as far as you progress, you die, you come back in right where you were, and here is a lot better than here. So the answer to that is, everything you do is beneficial.
Yeah, we understand that.
No, but you raised it is what if only one in 10,000?
Oh, yeah, no, I guess what my point is well...
No, if you the other answer to your question is how many people actually progress on the spiritual path?
Yeah, really.
Not that many and not right. that much. Yeah. Krishna himself said it. Yeah. 999 don't get very far. But that's all right. It doesn't...
Then what do you think is the reason why people don't get further? Is it their lack of effort? Is it their...
It's because delusion is really strong, and you. But let me take this into a completely different place. First of all, you never know. You have no idea when you're watching the way Yogananda put it. If you're pulling on a nail and you didn't hammer it in, and you don't know how long it is it just the tiny tip? Is it like this? So you're looking at someone, and they may appear to you to have a whole lot of really tough karma to be working through, but you don't know if it's just the last little bit, and as soon as that bit is done, they're free. Or someone who looks like they're doing, you know, terrifically well, maybe just having a good period, and you don't know what karma lurks. Unless you have omniscient sight, you can't evaluate other people. So you start from saying, one has no idea. Then you go to the second level, which is, and this is in direct answer to that, just look at it as an aggregate. Look at the people around you and don't ask, quote, how far they are, who's advancing. Just ask yourself if you see anything that you would like to be. If the aggregate effect of this is what you're going for, then the only thing you can do is take responsibility for yourself, because all that you know, all that we know, is I am suffering. And if certain actions alleviate my suffering and increase my bliss, it's not a question of quantifying it. If it's alleviated 1%, 2%, 100%, 9,000%, it's less suffering and more bliss than I had before I started. And it's a question of how hungry you are, and I'm going to come back to that. See, all the questions you're asking are when you're sitting and you're not that hungry, and so you can just look at a lot of menus. And you can look at the recipe books, and you can think about all these things. If you're really hungry, you know, all of that becomes much less important. It's just like there's a meal here, and I'm going to eat it. And people have very different levels of intensity of desire. And that's what I was saying. You have to have this balance point between whether or not you can stand your present reality. If your present reality is not so bad, then you can ask a lot of questions. When I met Swami Kriyananda, my present reality was unbearable. Nobody looking at me would have ever thought that. But inwardly, I was at a state of absolute desperation because it was like I was grown up enough. I was 22. I was on my own. I was living my life. And it was like the emptiness just stretched out in front of me. And it was sort of like, it's like karmically, I thought there was no point in having a nervous breakdown because I could feel that if I had a nervous breakdown, it would take a lot of time, energy, money. And in the end, I would be right back where I was standing. So that was pointless. I knew that suicide wasn't a good idea. I could see that drug addiction wasn't a good plan either. But continuing in my present state of consciousness was also an absolute living nightmare. And so into that walked Swami Kriyananda, and then everything changed. But if where you're sitting is okay, and I can hang out here a little bit longer, then you can afford to ask all these questions. And you'll keep asking them and keep evaluating and keep thinking and keep wondering until you are driven by overwhelming hunger to just start sitting at somebody's banquet table and trying to change, get out of whatever it is that you are now. And nobody in the world can move you through that. That's why proselytizing is just completely impossible. I mean, our way of doing it is simply, and you can see, I passionately put before you what I understand to be the truth, but how that integrates into your reality, whether it translates into this path, another path, or no path at all. And if you have a passionate interest in many different things, then you must follow it. You couldn't possibly be different. If you restricted yourself to Yogananda because somebody told you to, or something like that, and it wasn't a sincere expression of your consciousness, that would be a terrible idea for you. So, but if somebody asks me, as you did, why should you restrict yourself, I say, because if you mix up the vibrations, you're going to not really be able to sing as well as if you keep the vibrations straight.
Well, that's then it gets back to my question. It's not even so much even, like, say, for example, using your analogy about music, if you wanted to be a wonderful, if you were a pianist and you specialized in the music of Beethoven, a lot of piano sonatas you could play. You got a big palette to play from. But you could also say, well, Beethoven was influenced to some degree by Mozart, by Schubert. You could even go back to Bach if you wanted to, you know, and other contemporaries of Beethoven. And so you could say, well, you know, I know that he based this sonata on a fugue of Bach that he really particularly liked, so maybe I should start to listen to Bach a little bit. You know, and then it opens up.
But see, it would be, what you're moving from is, okay, let me just answer that back. Those are good ideas. And if a person is thinking, those are intellectual ideas. And so intellectually, if the intellectual curiosity is the driving force, and the reason is a driving force, and that's your nature, the person's nature, then you follow it. If you have a passionate love affair with Beethoven and you can't bear to be away from him for a moment, doesn't matter, all that stuff doesn't matter. Your love affair is with Beethoven. And you get from Beethoven everything you need and no other thought crosses your mind. That's why you have to be utterly sincere. Then another small factor comes in. Well, the French say appetite comes with eating, which is that if restlessness or a desire for to be stimulated with new ideas is a vritti that keeps you stuck, then there comes a point where you have to resist your natural impulse. And that's where I was saying earlier, not every driving inner impulse is actually dharma, because some of them are just self-perpetuating. And again, this becomes extremely personal. And I've said to you, but I know you understand, I'm not actually speaking to you. I'm speaking from your questions, because I'm not attuned enough. You know, I'm not talking to you, I'm talking to everyone. If you and I were talking and you raised these questions, I don't know what I would say to you. I would have to feel it differently. But these are the general answers to the things you're asking. Before you ask another question, let me see if anyone else has any. You may ask as many as you like, but let me make sure that is there more? I mean, through John's questions, I've basically said about everything there is to say. Is there other thoughts or questions that we haven't touched today or?
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I have a question, maybe just a comment. You know, you mentioned that when you first met Swami Kriyananda, mm-hmm. you just knew.
I was very lucky. That's not always the way it happens. Uh-huh.
Because that has never happened for me ever. So.
Well, Swami Kriyananda himself tells in his autobiography, which is called The Path, that he saw the book Autobiography of a Yogi in 1948. He was 22 years old. He was drawn immediately to Yogananda's face. He picked up the book. He had come across the excerpts from the Bhagavad Gita. He understood the idea of realizing God. He was planning to go to South America and be a hermit, and he was going to be a seaman, go off on a boat, earn money, save money, collect money, and then go off and live very cheaply in South America and be a hermit for the rest of his life. That was his goal. And in the midst of that, just before he could implement that plan, he goes into a bookstore and he sees Autobiography of a Yogi. He's very drawn to it. He opens it up and inside it says, dedicated to an American saint, James J. Lynn. And Kriyananda, Luther Burbank, excuse me. And Swami thinks, an American saint, impossible. Slams the book and puts it on a shelf. So he doesn't buy it. Not long afterwards, he's back in New York City where he was living outside of New York. And the thought of the autobiography comes to his mind, and the picture of Master's face comes to his mind. And he says, oh no, I'm spending too much money, I'm far too intellectual, I'm not going to read any more books. And he starts heading toward the seaman's office so he can get it on his ship, and he feels his physical body actually being turned and to head back to the bookstore. So he rushes into the bookstore, he takes the book off the shelf, he's holding it to his heart, and he's in relationship to Yogananda. This is 1948. This is like not a time when this was common. A schoolmate of his he meets in the bookstore, and the schoolmate's talking about going into the advertising business, he's going to make a killing on Madison Avenue, and all this stuff. And Swami, as he says, he's sort of holding the book closer and closer to his heart. He stays practically without sleeping or eating for 3 days, reads the book. Yogananda's still alive. He gets on a bus. He goes to Los Angeles. He meets Yogananda. He walks into him. Yogananda says, what may I do for you? Swami opens his mouth and says, I want to be your disciple. And Swamiji honestly says he never in his life imagined he would say such words to any other person. It was not in his character. Now, when Swamiji wrote that whole story up, I was his manuscript typist, I'm typing this story, I said, you know, almost no one comes on the path like this. And he said, I know. I said, it's going to give people the impression that if they don't have an experience like this, then this isn't really their path. He said, I know. He said, that's an unfortunate factor of the way it happened for me. He said, but it's the true story, and I have to tell the story as it happened. Because almost everyone comes in slowly. And just very slowly, the energy penetrates. You learn a little bit here, you learn a little bit there, you compare it to what you know, you test other waters, you keep coming back, and then very gradually the realization dawns on you that this really could be for you. It's just like falling in love and dating. Sometimes it's instantaneous, but often the realization gradually dawns on you that this could be someone that you could really spend a lot of time with. And that's really how it happens. My story was also dramatic, but And many people have stories like that, but not everyone. There's many people who start out by not even liking it. But they go away, they try everything else, and it lingers, and nothing else works out quite as well, and then they come back, and after 5 or 10 years, suddenly they say, well, I've fought it for all this time, now I think it's right. So the main thing is, you need to be moving forward. And if something is helping to expand your consciousness, stay with it as long as it's expanding your consciousness, because the act of expanding it will give you the knowledge you need to know. And don't follow anybody else's timetable and don't follow anybody else's schedule. Just step by step, do whatever you need to do to keep expanding your consciousness, and everything else will take care of itself. At a certain point, you also have to take yourself in hand. There's a point at which you have to also say, I've messed around enough, now I will put out more energy, because you can't be entirely passive, but you just have to be sincere to your own reality. Okay? Any other questions or thoughts? Okay. I think that will do us then, if you are done. If you have other further questions, I'm not in any hurry. As my friend says, I'll be the last one to leave the room. All right? Okay, thank you all very much for coming. This will, I think, appear on the internet before too long, and you can just download it that way, or you can ask them to make you a CD and they'll do that. Gemini. He said he's a Gemini and he's interested in everything, and so he's always eager to try the next new thing, he said, but he began to notice that once the newness wore off, he was essentially in the same, even though he had a sense of great accomplishment, he always ended up in the same place. And Swami's answer to him was, yes, going in circles gives you a certain sense of accomplishment. The bigger the circle, the greater the sense of accomplishment. Right. And then the man said, but, you know, I have so many questions and doubts. And Swami's answer was, he said, your doubts will never be satisfied by that method. He said, the only thing that will satisfy your doubts is an experience of peace. And the only way you'll have an experience of peace is if you focus and go deep in one place. And then you'll have that experience, and then the doubts will settle themselves. They won't settle themselves by constantly trying to fill yourself with information that'll solve them. Right. The answer answer did not come out of the man's questions. The man asked a certain question, and then Swami went to there because it was what he needed to hear. So, and it helped him. Yeah?
I'll say something that I kind of understand kind of where you're coming from now, but maybe I'm not in the right place, but this was like many years ago, okay, when I was working at a job here in Silicon Valley, and there was a disciple from this church that worked with me, and at that time I really thought that I was having a Kundalini awakening.
Uh-huh.
He basically said, you know, that's not possible because you're not practicing with me, you know, you're not mm-hmm. practicing where I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, he was no help.
Right.
And actually it turned me away from this place.
Yeah, well, there you have it.
You know,
it's a test on the spiritual path. I mean, I have no idea who you were talking with or how ignorant they were. But one of the things that invariably happens is that things will happen to turn you away from a path. And you have, it's the test, it's called the test of negativity, and it always comes. Either something like that, people will be here and then one individual will treat them in a horrendous way because we're not saints, we're just people. And then they'll decide the whole thing is worthless. And because if so-and-so could behave like that, then And our answer is always, you know, just what do you think? I mean, do you want to throw it all away because so-and-so is not perfect?
But isn't there something, I know, I mean, after reading the books, I mean, there is, I know there's a truth to being on one path.
Right.
And because I had a friend who did a study with Muktananda, and he said, you know what, I'm taking this path because I know that I'm going to reach my goal.
Mm-hmm.
You don't seem to know where you're heading. You know, you're all over the place, so you're never going to make it. You know, because I've got my sights set right here. And it's kind of the way that the teaching comes across.
I think comparisons are odious. Whether or not you're following your karma and whether somebody else is going faster by following their karma is presumptuous to say. Okay, now, but however, all the scriptures and all the masters speak of the necessity to concentrate and be loyal to one path. Now, the fact that people turn that into an extremely unpleasant dogma is highly unfortunate. You know, now it's that Jesus Christ is the only Savior, and if you don't accept Him as your personal Savior, you'll go to hell, was the beginning of Jesus saying, loyalty is the first law of God. You have to focus, and you can't practice everything at once.
Right.
So that's a truth. But you also cannot choose a path hypocritically or insincerely. But that's where, when I was telling the story of myself, if the path is true, and if you sincerely follow it, it will take you wherever you need to go. You don't have to worry. If it's a true practice, it will change your consciousness. If you follow it with sincerity and are honest in your relationship to it, it will take you where you need to go. And it will take you farther and faster than standing on the side of the swimming pool thinking about whether or not you're ever going to dive in, because the masters are not competitive. Does that make sense?
I guess,
would you like?
I just want to have hope. I mean, there's got to be some hope for the rest of us smugs who haven't really. I mean, I've been all over the board, and I've had all these experiences, visions. And when I was 7, I had a vision of Jesus, and Jesus said to me, I was raised as a Baptist, so that was pretty much of a nightmare. But I saw something deeper, you know. And I remember having this vision of going up in the church and saying, you know, I accept Jesus, and people were laughing because I was 7.
Right.
And I saw Jesus stand there and said, you know, they just don't get it, you know. It's okay.
Joyce, the question is a very simple one. Is it working for you? Is simultaneously doing many different things giving you what you want? If it is, then don't dream of changing it. If there's a sense within you of doubt as to whether that's a good path, and not just doubt planted by other people's dogmas, but a genuine inner doubt. If you're following what you're doing, but you're still hungry, then we have to begin to ask ourselves, and there's such a thing as spiritual authority. I didn't really end up speaking about that. I intended to. But there are orthodox traditions that once you peel away all the false overlay on them, there's still a kernel of truth in it. But if you're not... If you're perfectly happy, or if you're not discontented with what you're doing, you must be sincere. You must be loyal to yourself. You must be, because you'll never progress spiritually at all otherwise. So even if you can accept the theoretical possibility that someday I should concentrate, if that's not today, don't worry about it. Just be sincere, absolutely sincere in what you're doing. Give it your whole heart, but be open-minded to the possibility that something else could come. See, the only thing that'll cause you problem is that you become resentful of people telling you that you should concentrate, and you say, no, that's not true. You know, I don't care if all the scriptures have said that. That's not true. Then you've created two problems for yourself. One is that you may be scattered, and the second is you've closed yourself off to something that may be beneficial to you. So just be, this is what seems true to me at this point. This is my experience now. When my experience changes, my actions will change. And in the meantime, you know, Ananda is like, just speaking of us, yes, we have our spiritual path, and yes, you can become concentrated, but the doors are open, you know, there's no, we don't like scan your chakras before we let you in, you know? And like people on all kinds of paths with all kinds of interests, just, you know, come to our kirtans, come to our classes, come to our Sunday services, because it helps them, that's all we care about. I mean, we're not in the game for members either, you know? But when people ask me, I have to tell them what Yogananda said. I can't tell them something else. But if they ask, and this is what I was saying to John, if they say, what should I do? personally, then I say, well, what's your experience? Peter, did you have a comment?
Yeah. I thought John's question was great, and I was going to talk about it, but you just said it in the last couple sentences about, you know, he was kind of saying, how do you know, and what feels right. And for me, like, an analogy would be, you know, seeing people get involved with, like, Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous, and they could debate for a long time whether or not they're an addict. But then they go into the program, and it advances their life, and they feel better. And let's say, oh, no, you know, they're not an addict, or they're not an alcoholic. But it, after they got into it and they got involved and they felt that connection and they felt that with people, you know, it advanced their life. And whether or not they were an addict became kind of pointless because they felt it, you know, and I think it's what she's saying, you get connected. And kind of a similar thing is, you know, if I'm sitting with my scientist friend watching a sunset and she tells me the molecular structure of the atmosphere created that sunset, but for me, it's a total God thing. The sunset. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm connected. I know it's a God thing. It's a sunset for me because that's how, you know, I experience it. Mm-hmm. But scientifically, to a lot of people, it's
molecules.
Molecules in the atmosphere. Yeah. So
it can be both. Science is God also.
Yeah, it just depends on who you are. See, it's called self-realization. And every atom is dowered with individuality. This is the way we say it. There are universal laws. See, this is where it reconciles. There are universal laws. And all of Sanatana Dharma always speaks of the necessity to have a guru and to concentrate on that guru. It's a universal law. So that's one side of it. And the other side of it, it's self-realization. It's your path. You have to walk it your way. But the dangerous thing is to declare truth or falsity about something that you don't actually know. So just be ignorant. Allow that it could be true, it might not be true, but it doesn't seem relevant. When I was first with Swami Kriyananda, I lived in a dome for a time, and domes are curved like this, no straight walls, closets were a nightmare. And there was this place in that closet that was this little point way back like this, almost impossible to get to. And it would be a place where I'd put something like, you know, a present my mother gave me that I had to keep in case she came to visit. I couldn't throw it away, but it was completely useless. So I have to put it back there. I didn't want it in the front of my closet because it was in the way, but I couldn't discard it either. And then sometimes I would pull it out and I would think, gee, this is lovely. You know, I have a place for this now. Why don't I just use this? So I developed a mental shelf that was way out of the center. And when Swamiji would say things to me that did not fit, that I didn't like, that I didn't know how to use, I didn't dare discard them because I, insofar as I was able to appraise his wisdom and his understanding, he was way ahead of me. So when he would say things that I couldn't embrace, I also did not dare reject them because he was traveling in territory I had no maps for. So I would just wrap them up very neatly and I would put them over here. And then I could just work with what worked. And then I'd work with what worked, and then every so often I'd unwrap one of those ideas and suddenly it would fit me and I'd put it in the middle of my closet. But I didn't want to make the second mistake of presuming to know what he knew. And so I neither accepted nor rejected. I just said, And the way Sister Gyanamata put a disciple of Master, she said, you can say anything you want to the Guru as long as you say it with detachment and respect. Detachment from whether or not he's right or wrong, and respect for where he's coming from. But you don't have to accept it. You shouldn't accept it. Swami himself says, I much prefer a good argument, he said, than mindless acquiescence. Mindless acquiescence takes you nowhere. A good argument, you're engaged. You know, he's never, you know, been upset by people saying, that's the stupidest idea I ever heard. if it's an honest response. If it's a self-protective one, just self-justifying, not sincere, that's different. If it's like, I really want to understand this, but this makes no sense to me. That's good.
This is when I engage that one more time, maybe sure. Show how my experience was. Without meeting Yogananda, at the ashram, I felt connected through the people. And that was my connection.
Right.
I think everybody has it different. You know, you meet Yogananda or Asha's connection. But, you know, through the people I knew, it was my path. And
that's
through
exactly
what I was seeing and what I was feeling there and my energies. And then on like a different take, they're all talking about Kriyananda's books. And I'm looking at the Kriyananda books and I'm not really getting it. You know, I'm like, what do they see in this guy, these books? You know, and now I kind of know that's a material manifestation of a spiritual thing. So I'm supposed to get it from the book. So I'm not connecting with his writing. Then he comes to Ananda and I meet him and boom, it's totally different for me to see him live and see him in person and see him speak. So just for me, it didn't work through the book and it didn't work that way, but that's how it came for me and I think it's different.
You know, Peter, I have spent 5 or 6 years now doing book study courses because I know that people don't get Swami's books, so I've been teaching them. I've been teaching the Gita for 1.5 years. I mean, because I feel like an interpreter is needed. I mean, I myself, I'm looking at some of these things. Started with Hindu Way of Awakening. I'm reading this book, and I think, boy, this is a hard book to understand. It crosses my mind, nobody's going to understand this book. And so I started teaching it, because then my experience is closer to other people's experience, and I was able to, you know, draw by grace, because I was trying to teach it. I could grasp it in the moment that I would teach it, and then I would share it, and then people would say, oh, I see what this book is about. And that's how, what I was saying to John, that's how we all work with this. I didn't get Yogananda till I saw Kriyananda. My husband came straight through Yogananda and then had to understand Kriyananda. Everybody's different. And some people come through, you know, Jyotish or Devi or Savitri or Dharmadas, Nirmala. You know, they don't get Kriyananda, but they get somebody who's in tune with him, and then that person knows what other people are getting. So it doesn't really make any difference what you call it.